Blog Talk Radio.
Speaking to you live from Brooklyn, New York. This is the 26th of March, 2017, and again, it's a pleasure to have you join us. We're going to start the show, as always, with giving thanks to the One Most High, to our ancestors, to the Orishas, to the deities, to the guardians, to the angels, to those who continue to watch over us and bless us with the ability to wake up this morning, a morning like this morning, and to be able to breathe and have our breakfast and lunch and just to engage in our journey in this experience called life. This afternoon, we are really excited about having a guest, a special guest with us, a bassist who's world-renowned. His name is Alex Lane, and he is with us this afternoon to share with us his experience as a musician, as a bassist, as an elder statesman of the jazz community. And we just got finished hearing a rendition of his band performing at a club. Prior to that, of course, I was playing the drum, the African drum, the djembe, which I think is essential to have in every household, and that's something that we will talk about later on in the show. And along with us, we have my lovely wife, Dr. Dora Gray, who's joined us, and she's going to share her knowledge and her energy and love with us. And without any further ado, I'd just like to say good afternoon to Brother Alex. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you, Bubba?
I'm doing quite well, thank you. So much of a pleasure to have you with us.
It's my pleasure, indeed.
Yes. Matter of fact, we're both from Brooklyn.
In fact, I was surprised to hear you myself being referred to as an elder statesman.
Well, you are.
For so much of my career, I was always referred to as a kid.
Well, indeed, like it or not, you know,
yeah.
As they say, I'm going to love you whether you like it or not. I'm going to call you an elder statement.
Well, it's a blessing.
Like it
I mean,
not.
I accept it gladly.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I even came up with a label of name of griot, and mm-hmm. he was wondering what that meant. And indeed, that's an African term that's used by those in the village, in the community, who hold the history
mm-hmm.
of the community of the lineage,
mm-hmm.
you know, of the ancestors,
the storytellers,
mm-hmm. going back sometimes hundreds if not thousands of years,
mm-hmm.
and they know it verbatim,
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. you know, through memory. Mm-hmm. And I always think of brothers and sisters like yourself who've been through this particular unique journey mm-hmm. called jazz, mm-hmm. which is, as many would state, is one of the, if not the only original art form produced by this country,
mm-hmm.
Which started its journey in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's brothers like yourself who I've met who share this, just have a wealth of knowledge and of the history of this music.
Mm-hmm.
So I just like to share with the listening audience the fact that Alex was born here in New York City, as a matter of fact, Harlem, New York.
Correct.
And you begun your musical career in 1959 at Count Basie's nightclub.
Yes.
Right? And after attending high school of music and art, and I found out that you were an upstanding student with awards and acclamation.
Not at that point.
Okay. Yeah. Prior or
you
after?
Know, honestly, yeah, after.
After.
When
okay.
I returned to school at 30 years of age.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And at that point, I guess I could have been considered an outstanding student, and I did win some awards upon my graduation from Bronx Community College,
mm-hmm.
which is where I continued to. At first, I had to go back and get my GED. I left high school in my right after my sophomore year.
Okay.
So, you know, in music and art, in fact, I only stayed there a year because they wanted me to go to summer school. And at that time, that was out of the question for me.
Yes.
And so rather than go to summer school, and also I did have no idea of becoming a professional musician. I had just gained entry into the school sort of on a lark. They came by one day in the seventh grade and said, who wanted to take the test? And I raised my hand, you know, being sort of a wise guy.
Yes.
But I subsequently took the test, and to my shock, I passed it.
Oh, wow.
And because the irony is that I had been studying piano from 6 until 12. Right before my 12th birthday, I graduated from elementary school, and my mother called me, and she said, listen, I'm so tired of fighting with you about practicing. Do you want to stop taking piano lessons? I said, yes, thank God. I was, you know, I couldn't wait. So, I mean, that's what preceded my gaining entry to music and art. And I had always had this interest in bass somehow. I don't know where it came from. And I was fortunate enough to gain entry. I found out later on, I was fairly decent academically. But what the main requirement that they looked for was the ability to hear, my ear. And I didn't realize that I had probably what is considered above average ability to hear,
mm-hmm.
Even though I didn't know what I was hearing. I couldn't describe it technically.
Yes.
And so they said, you know, well, if you're not going to go to summer school, you got to get out of here. So I got out of there.
Well, you went on to community college and then, of course, Queens, and
yes.
Majoring in music, and had the good fortune, the blessing of meeting other bassists such as Stuart Sankey, and
yeah.
Ron Carter and Alvin Brim.
Brim. Yeah. Well, those are my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Ron was probably the first teacher. And we were, though unequal in skill, we were sort of equal in, I guess, close to the same age. And I even used to sub for him sometimes on various gigs when he could make it. In fact, I had the privilege of being subbing for a number of the top bass players at the time, Richard Davis and among
mm-hmm.
others. And Stuart Sankey was, Stuart Sankey was my first teacher. He was, I can't remember, he was from Juilliard, and that's how we had gotten his name. My mother called Juilliard mm-hmm. and asked him to recommend somebody. And Alvin Brim was the principal bass player for the New York City Opera.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he was, I credit him as being the first guy that really woke me up.
Mm-hmm.
As to what I needed to do in order to progress as a musician and as a bass player in particular, and to the fact that I'd actually been holding myself back by not forcing or being forced by my previous teachers to do things that I would have considered impossible. You know, and he did that in one lesson.
So he stretched you beyond what you considered to be your limitations.
Yeah, the first lesson he...
And the first lesson you was able to...
He threw out this music in front of me, and I said, huh? And I stayed there for about 5 minutes. He said, play this.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to myself, is this guy kidding me? Was he kidding me?
Yeah, triplets and all kinds of things.
Yes, and I struggled with that music for a whole hour.
Yeah.
And I was so frustrated. But when I left him, I realized that progress comes from breaking barriers.
Yes.
And that I had never really been forced through instruction at any rate to break barriers.
Mm-hmm.
I had been sort of forced to do so on the job. But that was my first, I would say, real awakening, which I'm forever grateful to him for, you know.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, honey, I just wanted to have the audience hear your voice and just to share the fact that you are also a violinist and being a string instrumental performer, that there's a synergy that you had immediately with Brother Alex. And I know that you've given me a violin, and I picked it up, and I have this uncanny ability to pick up an instrument
mm-hmm.
and get some kind of decent sound out mm-hmm. of it, because you know I play I started off with clarinet
mm-hmm.
and then trumpet, and one of my trumpet player actually was Sidney Baker, and he mm-hmm. he was a Philharmonic trumpeter,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't realize how difficult that is. And he was the first trumpet player in My Fair Lady.
Clarinet is supposed to be the most difficult
one
to read.
It is, and I was able to activate that. But going back to my wife, with her being a violinist and being a teacher as well, which requires quite a bit of patience to be
mm-hmm.
teaching children,
because mm-hmm.
they don't really readily have, most of them, the
interest
or the adaptation to get the sound that's required
mm-hmm.
to be acceptable. So just share with us, honey, your experience as a violin teacher and for what Alex has shared about him being able to be challenged to really up the ante in terms of being a proficient musician.
So first I'd like to just greet our listeners, Alafia, namaste, I greet you. In the name of the Most High, I thank you for taking your time out this afternoon to spend with us and to interact with us.
Yes.
Being a musician, and I humbly accept the label of being a violinist.
Mm.
I humbly accept that label. And music is one of the most spiritual and rewarding experiences that I believe a person can engage in. I kind of fell into music. It wasn't a choice. Later on, when I started playing guitar and, you know, I dabbled with the saxophone for a little bit, that didn't work out at all. But it just didn't. The woodwind instruments are not for me, but the string instruments, yes. In the elementary school system, I taught all of the strings,
mm-hmm.
violin, viola, cello, and stand-up bass. And the experience with the children, I can't describe anything more rewarding. To watch children pick up an instrument that, first of all, they didn't choose. They might have been forced into it by their parents
mm-hmm.
or just basically stuck with it because you're in that particular curriculum at school, and so you end up having to take music, whereby your counterparts might have ended up having to take a different subject. And so to be able to engage them to the point where they now love it, and we're playing Barry White tunes and things like that on violin, and like that's amazing to see children do that. But I always say, though, I'm qualifying amazing because our children are some of the most brilliant children on the planet, and I say that without reservation. Mm-hmm. They just are. So even though you're watching them and you're saying, wow, intellectually, you're not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can do these things
mm-hmm.
and more. So, you know, I could talk all day about music.
Mm-hmm.
However, we want to hear from your guest, Mr. Alex.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And but yes, there was a synergy because, as you know, like all three of us sitting here right now are musicians.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And there is that synergy that once you meet another musician, something just clicks, and that synergy exists. So it's a very powerful thing. That's why I say it can be a very spiritual experience.
Absolutely.
Musicians, music just spans the entire gamut.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you're a musician, you know that you have friends who are musicians who are, you know, sky's the limit. Race, gender, right? Educational level. None of that matters when you get together and you're playing music. That's why I call it a synergistic experience. You're just all together
mm-hmm.
forming one note.
Mm-hmm.
There's a app or a posting that I have that I post sometimes, and it has a picture of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that music illuminates every part of the brain.
Mm.
And also added to that fact is that music is actually really based on the science of mathematics.
Yes.
In every sense, rhythmically as well as tonally, it's all mathematical. And it also is based on a logic.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been proven that the study of music enhances one's intellectual ability to understand and master other subjects as well,
mm-hmm.
and which is why it, at least at one point in New York they had begun to almost include it universally in the primary levels of education,
mm-hmm.
I never understood why my mother was a teacher,
mm-hmm.
but she wasn't musically active at all. There had been some members of her family in the previous generation which purported to have been string players. But I never really understood why she almost insisted that my sister and I study music, other than the fact that the study of music it being the primary art is a part of what would be called a liberal arts education.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, she never said so, but I think that this was probably her idea of not, because never thinking that I would ever become a musician and not particularly ever wanting me to become a musician, because in those days, I'm going back 1940s, I mean, among the black community, being a musician among the good people was frowned upon,
mm-hmm.
because of, and especially jazz, because
right.
jazz is the origin,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so, I mean, my sister and I agitated for this piano. And one day, Christmas, we woke up, and there was a piano in the living room.
Wow.
So we started banging, and my mother said, oh, no. And we said, you know, no. She said, no, you have to take lessons. And I said, lessons? What's that? to my chagrin, I found out. But I was fortunate to have some very good teachers. My first two piano teachers were very good,
mm-hmm.
and the second one in particular, because I had some deficiencies,
mm-hmm.
and she recognized it, and she wanted my mother particularly to get me a metronome, and but my mother said, you know,
mm-hmm.
metronome, but I mean, most people even know what a metronome
right.
was, and those
right.
are what the purpose was, so
yes.
she never really proceeded. Of course, eventually, maybe 30 years later, I found out that how essential a metronome was in developing one's sense of time, of spacing, of beats,
right.
tempos, understanding tempo. So I practice using the metronome virtually every day.
No, you do?
Yes, yeah.
Well, the bass player is considered to be the metronome of the band, right?
Yes. Well, the drummer really fundamentally mm-hmm. has that requirement, that responsibility.
Yes.
But everybody in the bass player in the rhythm section must adhere to it.
Yes.
You know, within the scope of their performance, because it's the stability of the tempo that creates the level platform for the performers to perform on, because as I try to explain even to some of my students along the way, that essentially the bass, piano, and drums, especially bass and drums, mm-hmm. were accompanying instruments.
Yes.
You know, I mean, some, because of the rise of recognition of some popular people on the instrument, the solo aspect of it has become very important to players as well. But I said initially, the bass player and the drummer didn't solo, and they certainly didn't solo independently.
Right.
The piano, being the master instrument, they always had a solo capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting what you talk about in terms of not recent, but mm-hmm. in terms of 50 years or so,
mm-hmm.
that the bass and the drummer were allowed to take a solo.
Yeah, hell yeah.
And you've played with some of them, such as Ron Carter.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't play with
Roy Haynes.
Not Roy Haynes, but I played with Max Roach. I played with many of the top drummers. I mean, I'm trying to think of some of the names now, but, you know, people like Percy Bryson was with a number of the top singers, because I worked with a lot of singers. So Grady Tate.
Yeah, Carmen McRae.
Yes.
Gloria Lynn,
yes. That was Griselda Oliphant was the drummer on that.
Johnny Hartman,
yeah.
And even Mary McKeeba.
Mary McKeeba, yeah. That was, she was the cause that, or the person that actually enabled me to return to Africa.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I was.
So you say return? You were there.
Well, I mean,
previously,
no.
Oh, you mean in terms of just being an African American?
In terms of me being, I think, among the first black men of the 20th century to ever go back to Africa.
You
know what I'm saying? I went back in 1967.
Back then it wasn't even considered.
People didn't even
the destination.
Most black people didn't want to identify with Africa at all.
Yes.
They knew nothing about it. I mean, mm-hmm. the dashiki and the Afro and stuff had just began to come into some degree of popularity.
Yes, I remember.
So now I tell people, I said, the plane landed in Nairobi. It had this Afro about 2 feet in depth. Breath, and I had what we call a dashiki.
Yeah.
And I stepped off the plane, and I'm walking down the gangplank, and there's about half a dozen brothers or airport workers off on the side, a couple hundred feet away. And as I'm coming down there, they looked at me and they started pointing and talking in an animated manner. And I didn't realize that they had never seen a black man. First of all, there was nobody. In all the places I went to Africa, there was nobody with an Afro.
Where was this? What country? This was
Nairobi.
Nairobi, okay.
Yeah, Kenya.
Yeah.
There wasn't an Afro in sight,
right.
There wasn't a dashiki in sight. I tell people, I say, that must have looked like a clown. They must have said, hey, is this a circus? The circus is coming to Nairobi. Who is this guy?
Yeah.
And that was my awakening to the fact that all I had known about Africa was from Tarzan movies.
Yes.
That I had no actual knowledge. And I tell you, that month, about 6 weeks we spent there, I was just bombarded every day with realization. First of all, most of the Africans didn't even know we were in America.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even know, because there was no television.
Mm-hmm.
Very few had radio, and the radio was usually in the colonial language.
Yes.
You know, but there were some who could speak it. The leadership knew.
Mm-hmm.
People like Nkrumah and Sekou Touré, people who had
Jomo Kenyatta.
Yes, who had been educated overseas, or who had awareness of contemporary knowledge history.
Mm-hmm.
But the average brother didn't even know it, and I didn't realize until some years later when I became a follower of Elijah Muhammad,
yes,
that Mom said, yes, they didn't know because they had hidden us under his name. And when he first said, I said, what do you mean hidden us under his name? Then I realized what he was saying, that there was no African with the name Alexander Lane.
Right.
So if they read a report, if they were able to read the colonial papers, and they said, well, Joe Jones got lynched in Tupelo, Mississippi yesterday, or they burned down the house and killed his family, without, they didn't know that these were black people because we had the names of our slave master.
Right.
So they had no way of identifying with us. In fact, I often am amused by the adaptation of these African-sounding names that we have fallen in love with since Odessa, the late the 1970s. Everybody,
Tamika,
Taisha, Moisha, I can have no source or no identity with the original language, but just they tried to imitate the sound of the name.
Because names were given relative to the incarnation person of that soul.
Well, you were property. And
what that incarnation, the presentation of this soul back in the earth school, what its purpose was and what it represented in terms of its skills and
so this forth. Is why, you know, when you became a Muslim under Elijah Muhammad, we were given the designation X.
Yes.
And at some point, he began to give a few brothers what he called holy names, like Malcolm Shabazz and Farrakhan, Yusuf Shaw, who was the captain, brothers who had exemplified themselves by their service and commitment. And so a lot of other brothers said, well, we want so-called holy names. So they wanted to adopt the names. Of course, most of the Muslim names in the Middle East are actually names of descriptions of God. They were, I can't even forget the term.
Attributes
of God. Yeah, Salam, Muhammad, and all these names. So they appealed to the messenger and said, "Well, you know, we are Muslims." He said, "How come we can't, you know, adopt these names for ourselves?" He said, "Because a name identifies you."
Absolutely.
He says, you don't even know who you are. That's why I give you the X, because the X represents the unknown.
Yes.
I was just astounded by the wisdom of that he was emanating, you know, and I said, wow. And having been there and seen for myself, you know, and even with the European. That if you check out the origin of European names, they usually identify you with a profession or a place of origin or that kind of thing. You
Smith
know,
was a blacksmith.
Yes, a blacksmith.
You know, Gray was a farmer.
Yeah, or if you came from a certain town, your name was John, so and so, whatever the name of the town was, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, though I'd learned a lot in that initial trip to Africa, to put it in perspective, still remained ahead of me, because I went back in 1967, and I didn't become a Muslim until 1969. And it wasn't until I studied the teachings and the wisdom of Muhammad that I was able to put what I had learned in that initial trip into perspective.
Did you get a chance to meet Malcolm X, or did you engage with him?
I didn't meet Malcolm X, but I used to go. See, I came from a mixed culture family. My father was West Indian, and my mother was from South Carolina.
Interesting. So what part of the West Indies?
St. Vincent.
Okay.
And in my home, even though my mother attended Abbott Senior Church.
Ah, okay.
And she was a follower to some degree of Adam Clayton Powell. She used to go out on 25th Street and demonstrate when in the 1940s there were no employees on 125th Street above the position of janitor or cleaning woman. And Adam used to lead people out there.
But this is before Bloomstein.
No, Bluestein's was there.
I'm just saying in terms of employees. They didn't hire blacks back then.
No, they hired blacks, but none above the position of cleaning woman or maintenance man.
Gotcha.
So they were petitioning to be hired as salespersons, mm-hmm. even stock people.
Yes.
You know, you couldn't even think about some of the management.
Even an elevator operator for that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, because, so anyway, in my home, I had two parents who had overcome the vestiges of racism.
Mm-hmm.
And my father coming from the West Indies, the racism that existed there was never the same as it was in the United States to begin with, because he lived in a black majority society. So it was only same as in Africa. It was only a certain amount of control that they were able to exercise over the general population. And my mother, I don't know where she got it, but she was a college graduate in the 1930s, and as a woman. And that was almost unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
quite an accomplishment.
I mean, so they always talked about development, accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They never talked about being held back because of color. In fact, my father, when he opened up the grocery store, the white salesmen from the wholesale companies used to come by to sell him goods. And I would be in the store, and the white man would say, and maybe the store would be kind of crowded, and the white man would come and say, hey, Mr. Lane, can I take you? He's just bus friend. Say, hey, Mr. Lane, can I take your order? And my father would say, God damn, can't you see I'm busy? Wait till I finish. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that black men didn't talk to white men like that.
Uh-huh.
It was years later that I thought that I respected him. I said, wow.
He had to put his
face
to face.
Because he had come from a place where they weren't
exactly.
They weren't forced to that the level of submission.
He was a house Negro. He was a film Negro.
Yeah, well, not, even beyond that, they didn't have that. They weren't forced. They weren't forced in the West Indies and in Africa to that level of submission unless they passed for a house Negro.
Yes.
You understand?
Yes. Yes.
But the most of the population sort of ran on their own,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I guess I didn't even notice the reaction of the rest of the people around who were all from the South,
mm-hmm.
in our neighborhood. You know,
scandalized.
Yes, no, well they were in shock. I'm sure they must have been. I didn't pay any attention until I reflected on it later. I said, wow, you talking to white men like that? You know where they came from? That would get you a rope, a 10-foot rope, and with a knot on it. Or beat down at the very least, you know. But he did it without you thinking. Said, God damn it, can't you see I'm busy? I'm waiting there. You want me on? I'm waiting there. I'll be with you. And so, and then my mother always emphasized education.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't, long story short, fast forward, when I was in my late teens, I started listening to there used to be the Four Corners on 7th Avenue, 125th Street. That's where the activists used to speak.
I remember.
And the one that attracted me the most at the time was Carlos Cook from the African Nationalists. Because he was an excellent speaker. His utterances were full of humor.
Yeah, I don't remember him. I probably heard him.
He used to be on the northeast corner, mm-hmm. and Malcolm was on the southwest corner.
Yeah, I remember Malcolm.
It was chock full of nuts right there.
Yes, 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 I remember.
So I used to listen to Malcolm, but I never met him.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't become a Muslim until the year after he died. He was killed.
That was in 69.
I think he was killed in 68.
Yes.
I got my ex in 69.
Right. And was that at 116th Street?
In Brooklyn.
7C
in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
Yeah, Madison Street.
Yes, yes, yes.
And as a result, there were four musicians that were in the nation at that time here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Myself, Ben Dixon, very good drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Sonny Phillips, who used to work with, I'm trying to think, it's the organ player. I mean, a guitar player. Sir Charles Thompson.
I remember Sir Charles,
And another... A tenor player named, I think his last name was Washington, lived out on Long Island. So we became like the house musicians.
For the Nation.
For the Nation. We performed it all, because immediately when I got my act, I stopped playing in clubs. Mm-hmm. I was mistakenly led to believe that this is what was required.
Now, I remember us talking about the fact that you played at Woody Fest.
Yes.
I told you that I grew up with a number of brothers, namely Chuck Davis, who is known worldwide as Abbey Dune Oyewole.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, along with James Blake, who is also a member of the Nation of Islam,
mm-hmm.
he's known as Takbir Muhammad,
mm-hmm.
Charles Loveday, Elroy Williams, and a host of other brothers and sisters. And as synergy would have it,
mm-hmm.
synchronicity, you being a member of the Nation and being the house band,
mm-hmm.
as it were, that you had performed there, which was purchased by the Nation,
mm-hmm.
Nation of Islam, at least one of the buildings,
the
dormitory that I lived in, which was organized by James Blake, one of our
brothers. I didn't
brothers.
Know him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's just an interesting journey that how brothers and sisters such as us, we might look at each other and be in each other's
mm-hmm.
company,
mm-hmm.
but not recognize how God,
mm-hmm.
how the Most High, how the universe has made arrangements for us to come together.
Well, the thing that Muhammad said, he said that those who best understood what he was teaching
mm-hmm.
were musicians and doctors. And he never explained specifically what he meant. But in trying to understand it, I assumed that these were two professions that required a great deal of analyzation.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have been the reason why he said that, because what I found when I got in the Nation, as he used to say, he said, my followers followed me in doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Because they adopted the general philosophy, the general teachings, but they never studied in depth. When you got in the Nation, you were given lessons. In fact, in order to get your X, you had to memorize what they call the student enrollment and another sheet called actual facts.
Mm-hmm.
The first question in the student enrollment was, who was the original man?
Mm-hmm.
And it said the answer was, the original man is the Asiatic black man, maker, owner, cream of the planet Earth. And so, I mean, the first thing that stuck out was he said Asiatic. And I pondered over that, the use of that term, for quite a while. Subsequently, I learned that the name Africa was the name given to the continent by Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
I have not yet been able to ever find out the origin or its meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But subsequently, when I looked at the map, I found that actually, rather than having seven continents, as the Europeans have described, that they actually maybe only four, because Asia, Africa, and Europe are all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And the continents are usually defined by being completely surrounded by water.
Yes.
You know, but you can walk from Cape Town all the way to Beijing
mm-hmm.
without touching any water. You
mm-hmm.
might have to cross a river or something,
right.
but the land mass itself is continuous. Yeah, so when I got my ex, I was in the, it was ironic because, I mean, just going back to reflecting what you say about destiny. When I got my ex, the paper quota was 150.
Guys.
So I got my, the Savior's Day was our big celebration.
Yes.
To celebrate the birth of Master Farah Muhammad. I went to Chicago, I got my ex. When I came back, they had raised the quota from 150 to 300.
Wow.
And the next week, the mosque was empty.
Mm.
All the brothers had gone
mm-hmm.
because they weren't even selling 150.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, as new recruits, I guess, they initiated a 6-month training program. Prior to that, the training program had been 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So we were instructed in everything from self-defense
mm-hmm.
To spiritual matters. Mm-hmm. And so we were actually given a view of Islam in a much in-depth, greater in-depth sense than had ever been presented before. And, of course, we had lessons. And at the time, I didn't understand. Lesson number one was 14 questions and answers. Mm-hmm. And some of them were long. They maybe give you the first four or five. And you had to memorize them mm-hmm. and come back to the mosque and recite them. Mm-hmm. And upon successful recitation, they gave you the next set. And I didn't realize what an important training regiment this was. Mm-hmm. The reason why we were told that it was done because when the police used to raid the mosque, which they would do periodically, the first thing they would seem to go after would be these lessons. Mm-hmm. And Muhammad, of course, you know, he was put in jail during World War II mm-hmm. for not refusing to serve in the military. Yes. And I think it was during this period that he realized, because we were told to put the lessons on official paper, which was to memorize them. Because once they were on official paper, no one could ever take them from you.
Absolutely.
You can study them anytime you want. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize at the time how important being able to remember is essential to one being able to reflectively review mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. and for the purpose of greater understanding. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it really developed. I think I've had a decent memory to begin with.
Yes.
Maybe even a little above average because when I was about 11, my mother entered me in these oratorical contests mm-hmm. with the Elks.
Okay.
And the subjects were always something to do with what we would call it, I guess, Freedom Fridays. People like Frederick Douglass, Murray McBride was doing. We had to research the history of these people and offer an oratory review, oratorical review mm-hmm. of their life and their achievements and so forth. So I realized later on that this had also begun to develop my ability to remember. Mm-hmm. And of course, when I went into music, I didn't realize, but as a child, my mother used to have music in my day was all, radio was all music. Mm-hmm. So all the standard tunes, all the, especially the Broadway, the Tin Pan Alley,
yes.
all the stuff that the jazz musicians adopted in the jazz later on, were on the radio all day.
So you were able to...
And when I first got on these gigs, these guys would call these tunes out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could barely read music anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't even have chord changes, but I was able to harmonize these things. And the old guys used to look around me on the bandstand and say, wow, they say the kid's all right. And that's how I was able to progress in music so quickly.
Uh-huh.
Because in my day, in those days, a lot of the bass players, except for the very good ones, a lot of the bass players didn't even play the right chords. They had a beat, which is why the bass overtook the trombone.
Uh-huh.
Because the trombone had the sound, but it had no beat.
Uh-huh.
But the bass had a beat.
Right.
So they had a good beat. My beat was terrible.
Uh-huh. Yeah, good sound.
Yeah,
terrible beat.
No, I didn't have, my sound wouldn't look good, but I had a terrible beat.
Uh-huh.
But I could sort of play around the correct notes.
Right.
And I say play around because my intonation, I didn't even understand the concept of intonation until I guess 10 years later when Carmen McRae fired me after working with her for years.
Yeah, Carmen was one of my favorite singers.
She called me in California one night. She said, listen, I said, what? She had my money, my salary, my ticket on the table. She said, I got to fire you.
Uh-huh.
I said, fine, what? She said, because you play out of tune, and I can't stand that shit no more. And I didn't even know what playing out of tune meant. Because I came from a piano background. So I was trying to play the bass with my eyes, not with my ears. And some 6 months later, after she let me go, I was on a job, and I just happened to put the bass neck, my ear to the neck of the bass one night, and I heard it. So So I called her the next day. I called her. She said, "Who is it?" I said, "Alex, what do you want?" I said, "I just want to thank you." She said, "Thank me for what?" I said, "For telling me the truth." She said, "Well, you're not getting the job back."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, yeah. I'm not trying to get the job back, but I just wanted to think, because I realized that everybody else knew it."
Mm-hmm.
And the guys that I've been hanging out with and even working with, nobody said anything to me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that there were certain jobs that I couldn't even get because of my bad intonation.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to realize from that point that learning to play or improving my play meant improving myself on the different components
mm-hmm.
required to perform. Intonation, rhythm, reading, all these things. And that's what really set me on this mission of learning about how music was put together and what I had to do this book, because my teachers never told me this.
Mm-hmm. So you had an intuitive way of adapting to understanding what was necessary.
Well, I had a good ear.
And your good ear.
I had a good ear, and that was the whole sum total of it. But I had no understanding theoretically of music,
mm-hmm.
And so that's why I went back to school.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, what I wanted to, we were going to take a break, at least I was going to take a break, but it seems as if we're in such a flow, and our show is not going to do justice in terms of what we could, review and what you have to share with us, the listening audience, and my wife and I. But I do want to touch upon, though, before we get to the end of this show, is health.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very impressed when, we became friends on
mm-hmm.
Facebook
mm-hmm.
that you would do postings relative to health.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the religious aspect of our life
mm-hmm.
plays a significant part in terms of how we develop as human beings, as man and woman, to grow from children to teenagers to young adults
mm-hmm.
to older adults, senior adults, and so forth, relative to health practice.
Mm-hmm.
And you were blessed through the Nation of Islam to be
mm-hmm.
exposed to how to eat and live,
mm-hmm.
And teachings through your peers and brothers and sisters who were traveling in that journey
mm-hmm.
to encourage one another to have a healthy lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
to not eat pork,
mm-hmm.
And if you do eat meat, that it's a certain way you should cook it and so forth. And indeed, in Islam, we have what is called halal,
mm-hmm.
and in the Jewish community, we have kosher.
Same thing. Yeah.
Same thing. And a lot of us are not even cognizant of the
mm-hmm.
importance of the fact that the type of food you eat affects the way you think, affects the way you perceive the Most High in terms of your God, whatever
mm-hmm.
you call him or her.
Mm-hmm.
And
or it.
And or it. Yes. And so, as Malcolm would say, I always refer to him in terms of we've been bamboozled,
mm-hmm.
we've been hoodwinked.
Mm-hmm.
To think that we can take off the chains,
mm-hmm.
From around our neck, that yoke,
mm-hmm.
and be free.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us are walking around here with the car, with
mm-hmm.
the house, and looking muscular and
mm-hmm. yes,
voluptuous and beautiful and what have you, but our minds, our psyche.
Not only that, but our physically, we're dead inside.
And we're dead inside.
And we're diseased and
mm-hmm.
infirm, and we don't even realize. I was just listening to a program as I was waiting outside to come into your apartment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a doctor called Eric Braverman.
Yeah.
And he comes on every Sunday on 770.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about the fact that when you come to him, he analyzes your total body with computers.
Yeah.
But the most important part of your body that he focuses in on is your brain.
Yes.
And he was saying that so-called modern medicine is but anyway, it's broken down into individual areas, individual
yes.
disciplines.
Yes.
He said, which when you go to a doctor, he, if you go for an allergy doctor, he sees you for allergy. You go for a urinary problem, it's a urologist.
Yes.
But he says, these problems are usually connected to other problems.
Mm-hmm.
And they all eventually are connected to your brain.
Yes.
So that he purports to treat you in a totally holistic manner, giving you the most, placing the most emphasis on your brain health, which is that it is determined by the knowledge that you have and the type of knowledge that you get.
Yes.
I posted the other day on Facebook about this, the whole idea of eating, that we have eating in this society under this Eurocentric leadership has been geared towards pleasure.
Yes.
We eat for pleasure. But this was not the fundamental reason for eating. Eating was meant to sustain life.
Yes.
And hopefully to prolong life.
Mm-hmm.
But what we are, they're just like soul food. I mean, the interesting thing is that, you know, soul food was given to us initially because it was the cheapest way to maintain us. It was the garbage that the white man didn't even want.
Yes.
And that's why the pork was so prominent.
Yeah.
Yeah, the intestines, the hair, hog head, all the hoof, all
and
that
stuff. And the ironic thing is that the intestines, like, which is called chitterlings, is served during Thanksgiving, Christmas, during the major holidays.
Yeah.
That's a specialty now. You're going to serve chitterlings.
But in my studies, I found out that ancient, so-called ancient man hardly ever ate muscle tissue, which is the main form of meat that we eat today.
Mm-hmm.
That if when you study anthropological history, that when they killed an animal, the chief hunter, who was usually the bravest or the most skillful, he was given his choice of what to eat. And he always went for the organs. If you look at the predators, the lions and other elements, other predatory animals, they when they kill something, the muscle tissue is the last thing they eat, and bones. They always go for the internal organs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a child, I hated meat.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was about 8 years old, I was judged to be allergic to all fowls.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't eaten chicken or turkey, any bird, since that point in my age.
Mm-hmm.
This is some 70 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And the only meat that I liked was beef liver. I used to like liver and onions. And people used to mock me.
Mm-hmm.
Say, oh, man, beef liver, wow. But subsequently I found out, when I began to study nutrition, that the liver is the most nutritious part of the animal. It's part of the animal, of all animals, where the nutrients are all stored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has other functions as well, but primarily. But the liver, the heart, the lungs, and the brains are the most nutritious part of any animal. And so if you're going to eat meat, as the ancient men did, that's what they ate. It wasn't until fire came along that made eating muscle tissue, as well as a lot of legumes and beans and nuts, accessible.
Right.
Because prior to fire, it was too difficult to chew it.
Right.
You know, especially as men begin to age in their 20s and 30s, many times they lost their teeth or their teeth were in bad shape. So, you know, and finding these things, I was astounded. Of course, the irony, I posted the other day about Elijah Muhammad, he only wrote two books.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I made a copy of that posting you did. You started off with this morning while stretching my magnificent body in an effort to maintain and continue my good growth. I was once again inspired to give thanks to my Creator for providing me with such an outstanding vehicle with which to make my journey through time, this life. I've been analyzing and studying my physical self for about 60 years, and the more I learn, the more amazed I've become at the wisdom of the Creator who first conceived us and then brought us, man, woman, into production. We marveled at how automobiles from year to year show improvements in every facet of our existence, design, performance, accessories, etc. For example, but show no appreciation for constant improvement and development for that which has taken place in man from the beginning of our existence here on Earth. I just wanted to add that my wife and I both, we're vegetarians.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a vegetarian now, going on 28 years,
mm-hmm.
and I'm also a marathoner. And I would have friends of mine back in the day, going back when I started considering being a vegetarian,
mm-hmm.
how are you going to run marathons or run, period, and not eat meat? You know, that's where you get your protein from. But as you mentioned earlier, your legumes and other vegetables, you know, provide protein.
Everything has protein.
Exactly. in large form. And then we find out that everything indeed has a certain element of protein. And these same individuals, though, they consumed a lot of sugar.
Yes.
You know, they consumed a lot of things and so-called food that wasn't really good for us, and meat being included, because it was not being cooked properly, or if not purchased from righteous
mm-hmm.
Providers, butchers who really knew that the animals were not fed adequately, healthy rather.
Or killed in an unrighteous,
unhalal, unkosher manner.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there goes to saying that, a lot to say that indeed, those in our community of 7 billion people
mm-hmm.
throughout the world who eat meat, the majority of them have a certain reverence
mm-hmm.
towards the food, especially the meat,
because mm-hmm.
they recognize that animal, that being, is a sentient, is a being that has a soul.
Mm-hmm.
And they give reverence to that that particular animal for providing it with nourishment.
Mm-hmm.
That it being the person with nourishment, which is going to sustain their life. But here in the Western society, we have an indifference. We're conditioned to be indifferent. You know, when you say grace, you're just going through rudimentary, you know, just say a non-conscious ritual of saying grace and not really dealing with the meaning. And also, if it's not kosher or halal, the blood's in the meat, which has the adrenaline in the meat, which causes a certain psychological, so forth.
Adrenaline is a poison.
Yes.
It's the fight or flight hormone
mm-hmm.
that the adrenal glands secrete whenever you are under stress or
yes.
in danger. And it provides your body with an extra amount of energy. But the continuous consumption of it
mm-hmm.
is actually detrimental to your body.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our big problem, as I've learned primarily from Muhammad, was our ignorance of this language. We use words and we don't even really know what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Canadian philosopher, the guy that did created a geodesic dome, I can't think of his name right now, but he had a statement. He said, the word is not the thing. And so when people use the word protein, they have no idea what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They're repeating what they were programmed
right,
to say. You know, the reason why meat is supposed to be the preferred source of protein, you know, is because it possesses theoretically, the 8 essential amino acids.
Right.
Proteins are amino acids,
mm-hmm.
of which there are somewhere a number in the 20s.
22.
Yeah, 22 of these amino acids. And so the white man in developing his medical research has discovered that meat was this one source where all of these essential amino acids could be acquired.
Right.
What they also discovered was that in the Latin culture, the beans and rice, that a mixture of legumes and grains or seeds and
mm-hmm.
and other things can also provide you with the same. And this is why some of the dishes, the ethnic dishes in other groups, have become popular.
Mm-hmm.
Not because the people realized that they were getting the amino acids, the certain amino acids, but because they invariably promoted more health.
Right.
And sometimes a lot of the ethnic diets are just a matter of availability.
Yes.
You know,
such as meat.
Yeah, you ate what was available to you in your, the part of the world that you came up in. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, they take great pride in it, but they're among the items that each ethnic group consumes for nourishment are many items that are no good, as well as there are some items that are exceptionally nutritious. Mm-hmm. I've been eating lately what they call these superfoods.
Mm-hmm.
This is a concept that has arisen in the last 5 or 10 years. And these superfoods now come from all areas of the world, and they combine them now in these powders.
Mm-hmm.
And these are supposed to be the most nutritious edible foods, things like spirulina,
right,
and chlorella.
Yeah, wheat
and,
germ.
Yeah, wheat germ, all these things. So,
flaxseed oil.
I mean, it's, you know, the medical research or the scientific research is bringing to light so much of what we were unaware of about how and what food to eat, how to prepare it. I mean, one of the big things about Muhammad's book, How to Eat to Live, people used to scoff at it because they said, well, everything was so repetitive. He kept saying the same thing over and over again. And I was kind of pretty missed by it too. But I realized this is how you teach.
Yes.
You know, and he was trying to teach.
Now, one of the things is that going back to the African tradition,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is your experience when you went to Africa, to Robi, I think you said,
I was in
West Africa.
I went later, subsequently I went out of Africa, but on that trip I went to Kenya and Tanzania primarily.
Tanzania, okay.
Yeah.
And I understand that Swahili
is
in Tanzania.
That's all over, that's Tanzania, Kenya, Uganda,
mm-hmm.
and maybe there's another two other countries in that East African belt, mm-hmm. that area around that, I guess, not, it's below the, what they call the Horn.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but that's the peasant, pervasive, so-called indigenous language.
Yes.
You know?
So the what struck me from reading books such as The Healing Wisdom of Africa,
mm-hmm.
of Water and the Spirit by the renowned shaman, Dr. Maladome Some, and then also Yaya Diallo, The Healing Drum, and Brother Mitchell Hall. They emphasized the fact that indeed the musician was designated in the African community as being the healer.
Mm-hmm.
He or she was the one that had the knowledge of herbology,
mm-hmm.
And diet. If someone got sick and ill, they would prescribe a certain portion for them to consume,
mm-hmm.
and for them to get well,
mm-hmm.
and to heal from a physical perspective as well as from a spiritual perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And my mission is to inspire those of us who are musicians to do like what you're doing, to develop a certain understanding of how important it is to have a healthy diet and to become healers, as,
mm-hmm.
as it were. You know, unfortunately, through the jazz community, a lot of us didn't have that knowledge, you know. And there's another story about that in terms of when you're consuming intoxicants, alcohol,
mm-hmm.
and drugs and what
mm-hmm.
have you, and there's a whole conversation about that, why we were inclined to want to use certain drugs which were barbiturate in their nature,
mm-hmm.
to bring us down from this high experience of creating this beautiful music called jazz, and then of those of us who were depressed who wanted to use something to lift us up,
mm-hmm.
using the drugs that have like an amphetamine type of characteristics, such as cocaine. I'm not going to go through the conspiracy theory, you know, road, if you will,
mm-hmm.
but it is my desire that in our lifetime as elders, that we can reverse that tendency, reverse that particular direction of self-medicating, of not really picking up the mantle,
mm-hmm.
that we had before we came here as slaves,
mm-hmm.
of as musicians being the healer of the community as opposed to one who's part of the instrument of the destruction of our community. With that being said, we're at the end of the hour.
Okay.
And I just want to thank everyone who joined us to listen to our show. Indeed, this is Barbara Wesley Gray, who's had the pleasure of having Brother Alex Lane as our guest, esteemed guest.
It's been my pleasure.
And I really appreciate what you had to share with us and for your attending our show. For those of us who would like to contact, do you have any contact information you'd like to leave?
Well, they can always follow me on Facebook, of course.
Uh-huh.
The name is spelled L-A-Y-N-E.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone wants to contact me directly, my phone number is 917-763-0748. Again, that's 917-763-0748.
Thank you so much. And those of us, those of you listening, rather, if you'd like to contact myself, Barbara Wesley Gray, you can do that at my website at www.drumsofchange.com. That's, again, www.drumsofchange.com. Phone number 888-338-2508. Again, that's 888-338-2508. I thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to having you on board again with us next week, same time. That would be Sunday at 1 p.m. And as always, we end the show by giving homage and giving thanks to the one Most High God, to whatever name you give he or she, that indeed we are thankful for being able to connect with one another. We give thanks to the ancestors. We give thanks to the deities. We give thanks to the guardians. We give thanks to the angels. All of us are realizing now more so than ever that we are only strong by us being connected to one another and helping each other in our journey. So again, peace and love to everyone, and we will see you the next time.